Welcome.
Hello once again, everybody, and thank you for joining me here on this Monday, October 22nd edition of Bang the Book Radio. My name is Adam Burke, your host for the next hour and a half or so. Let's go over all kinds of things in the world of sports from a betting focus. Glad to have you with me to kick off a new week here on Bang the Book Radio. Two guests joining me on today's program. The first, Joe Everett from Draft Scouts and Insider Football for our NFL Week in Review and Monday Night Football Preview segment. Tonight's game coming up, the Giants and the Falcons, so we'll break that one down. Then also take a look back at some intriguing things as we go forward here in the NFL regarding a handful of teams that had a mixed bag of results on Sunday. Second half of today's show, Kyle Hunter from huntersportspicks.com for our Week 9 college football first look. Incredible to think that we're already in Week 9 of the college football season. We'll start things off, though, by talking about college basketball power ratings, the construction of those based on a listener request that we got over the weekend. Then we'll get into the college football stuff, some stats and trends, break down a few games, things of that sort. Over at bangthebook.com, we are your one-stop shop for sports betting news and information. My Week 9 college football power ratings have been posted over there. Don't expect this to happen again, but the power ratings plays suggest at the bottom of last week's article went 9-0. So hopefully we wind up with some similar luck here this week, but the college football power ratings are updated over there, as well as a college football opening line report. My World Series preview between the Dodgers and the Red Sox also up over there, along with Parker Michaels' daily NHL picks, a couple of good NBA previews. We've got, I'll have golf up here later on today, NFL opening line report later on today. We'll have more NFL and college football stuff as we go throughout the week. So definitely keep it tuned over there at bangthebook.com. Lots and lots of great stuff going on. Don't forget about those free pick contests as well. Our sportsbook reviews, you know about that promo code over at BSI Sportsbook, Bang100. Good for 100% deposit match bonus over there. Very, very busy time of year. College basketball added to the slate very soon here as well. You want to have multiple sportsbooks to shop around for the best lines, the best prices, the best juice, all that type of stuff. If DSI isn't one that you have, you may want to consider giving them a look. Two guests here on today's program. The first one, Mr. Joe Everett from Draft Scouts and Insider Football for our NFL Week in Review and Monday Night Football Preview. Joe, how's it going today, man?
Not bad. Not bad. Starting to tighten up the bolts and get a few things figured out in this league. But, yeah, there's still a few mysteries out in the NFL, but finally getting a grasp, it seems.
There are a lot of things I can't figure out about the NFL this year. I mean, obviously everyone knows my Super Contest record is not great, which is certainly disappointing, but it's amazing. And I was talking with some people yesterday, so many games now coming down to kicks, whether it's field goals or extra points. Obviously, once again yesterday, more boneheaded coaching decisions. Tampa Bay, a lot of late game stuff there that didn't make a whole lot of sense. Settle for a 40-yarder where they had two or three timeouts, could have moved it closer to the goalposts, settle for the 40-yarder and miss it. Of course, win on a 59-yarder in overtime. Once again, Jason Garrett having no idea how to manage the end of a game. It's maddening. It's hard enough to beat the NFL. But when you've got to deal with incompetent coaches and then, you've got bets relying on the right foot of kickers, it just makes it that much harder and that much more frustrating.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just beyond the coaching, just the kicker conundrum. I can't imagine what it's like for some of these players, particularly the linemen who were just battling snap to snap, just taking a beating, and then it comes down to the right or left foot of a place kicker that plays, I don't know, what would it be, 8-9 total plays out of that entire game? What stake did he have in it? So that question comes into it. But, yeah, I just can't get over it. Jason Garrett still having a job. And, it's noticeable, everyone making fun of him being the clapper. How many times have you seen him clap this season? I think word's finally gotten to him that it's like, dude, not only are you losing, you look pretty foolish clapping consistently throughout everything, so much so that you think he boards the plane clapping. So I think it's finally stopped on that end, but what hasn't stopped is these terrible decisions. I think it's finally come to a point where Jerry's got to question this whole tenure and finally put it to an end.
Yeah, and we'll see if that winds up being a thing. I mean, you know, again, it just, and I was talking with some buddies yesterday when I was out watching the game, it just blows my mind that we're talking about billion-dollar industries, and you have people in decision-making capacities just consistently getting this wrong. It's just, I don't know, it's crazy to look at, and, you know, again, I mean, it makes a tight NFL market that much tougher to try and beat. So let's see if we can beat the market here tonight. Giants taking on Atlanta. Giants, a super contest play for us in a couple of our entries. A little bit of a line value grab in with regards to that game. The super contest line, 5.5. Market opened 4.5. And now we've even seen a 3.5 creep onto the board there at Pinnacle. So, you know, Joe, we talk about context clues in the betting market. We talk about, you know, looking to see if we can pick something up from the line movement or the line itself. The Giants have been kind of a train wreck throughout the season. Obviously, there's a bunch going on with Eli Manning. Odell Beckham's not happy. Saquon Barkley's been really good, but a lot of people wondering if the Giants maybe should have gone with a different approach in the draft. And here they are, in the face of all of that, taking money tonight in a primetime spot against Matty Ice at home and the Atlanta Falcons. Pretty interesting line movement here, to say the least.
Yeah, and I guess explain it, you know, they can't lose 4 in a row, can they? Well, I'm here to tell you they can. They're on the road. They still don't have anything figured out. I think psychologically this team is a lot of – I'm just shocked. Sterling Shepard starts just going out and lashing out like that. He never did anything like that at Oklahoma that I can remember. I mean, this – pretty much a good kid. I don't know how this is happening. It's like Odell is sort of by osmosis leaped into Shepard. I know they're tight, but man, that's some of the things you see this happen that has to be going on in the locker room is boggling my mind. But what still is head scratcher is Shermer not being able to figure out protections. And, you know, I know they've had to shift Eric Flowers out and get rid of him flat out, but still, like, you made your changes. That's one of the things Shermer is so good at, is just teaching his quarterback how to manipulate a pre-snap. And I think that's why they had so much success in Minnesota. It wasn't the talent of that offensive line. I'm here to tell you, they're still bad in Minnesota. That's why they lost that game against Buffalo. They just could not block anybody. And I think that's where Shermer's talents lie. So I've got to think eventually that will be figured out. And if you're going to get it figured out, this is the team. I mean, on offense, the problem's been Eli. It's just, believe it or not, he can throw a catchable pass on time when he gets those clown shoes set, but that's been the problem. I think the lack of pass rush for the Falcons, that's where the Giants could have some success. I mean, really, it's a mash unit on defense. You're looking at two healthy corners. They got a hell of a nickel, Brian Poole. The kid from Florida, he's like the last one left as far as a tone setter for that secondary with Keanu Neal out of there. I do like Kazee, but really it's a lot of young guys. And then the linebacker unit, that's where the real difference is. Evan Engram, I'm not sure if he's 100%, but he's back from that injury. He should eat with this group of backers. I think we see a lot of short passes that I don't know how many big plays or deep shots we're going to get. But I think if the Giants are smart, they'll nickel and dime the Falcons to death. They're just mixing the runs with that phenom rookie they've got. I think everybody knows his name. So, you know, you'll see the big plays by Saquon. He needs about 10 to 13 touches, and you can guarantee two of those are probably 40-plus plays, especially against this defense. So I think, you know, maybe a yardage prop with Saquon might be the smart way to go, because one big play may just get you there. Rather two, because it will be high. But still, I think Evan Engram will be a difference maker here. And just situationally, like I said, Shermer is on notice too here. It's not just the players. That he's got to get some things figured out. And then just as a team for their manhood now, like, it's been three losses in a row, and not only that, there is too much talent on that side of the ball, so they have to score, not just win, score. If they don't score against this, serious problems. I don't think Odell's going to just resort to attacking a water cooler. It may be something larger and more ominous, and I think that's real. There will be an agenda to put some points up, I think, for the Giants. And then on the other side, just kind of standard operating procedure for Atlanta. You're going to see Sark's little version of the West Coast, a lot of Julio early and often, and, you know, just flashback old-fashioned SEC battle, Florida Gators, Janoris Jenkins, Alabama, Crimson Tide, and Julio Jones. I mean, that's about as good as it gets still. I mean, Jack Rabbit can still play. The Giants are running more, a little bit more than usual in man that I see, so maybe that benefits Julio enough. I know who it does is if they don't use zone, that Ridley probably has another game. That rookie has been hot for him. I know he's injured, but he and Sanu, they're dinged up, but they're going to play. So they've got their three wide set. That'll be an issue for the Giants. And then they've been using a lot more Austin Hooper the last few games. So as a tight end, I don't know how they match up with him. I mean, I just can't help but flashback to the preseason. Alec Ogletree getting burned up the seam off of David Njoku of the Browns for that touchdown. I know it's just preseason, but I know when somebody can't run. And Ogletree didn't have a prayer catching Njoku, and Hooper's no stiff. So I think they have problems there. I think Falcons get up on the board here, and, you know, me smells an over in this one. I hate Sarkisian because of some of these play calls he has in the red zone, but I really look at a scenario, just too much talent to mess up here. I've said that about a few teams, and I think that the Atlanta offense is that. There's just so many pass catchers, and then how well Matt Ryan, I don't know, I don't want to put too much pressure on him, but at home in Atlanta, Matt Ryan's a totally different animal. You get him on the road in some adverse conditions, or apparently in the state of Pennsylvania, but in that new Mercedes-Benz Stadium, so far so good for Matt Ryan and the offense. So, yeah, I'm looking at a high-scoring game. I don't like a side, but I took total pretty early, and I'd take it again.
Well, like I said, I mean, we've got some investment here on the Giants from a super contest standpoint. I don't think I'll have anything going on with this game tonight. Lots of question marks on both sides, especially for Atlanta now without Devontae Freeman. Do they work Ito Smith in a little bit more? Do they actually figure out how to use Tevin Coleman correctly, which is something that Sarkisian has not been able to figure out here so far. But then on the other side, you know, the Giants, I mean, if the Giants can't move the football against the Falcons defense with all of their injuries, who can they move the football against? Will they do it against Washington next week? I don't know. After the bye against San Francisco? Maybe. Short week against the Buccaneers? Maybe. You know, the Giants have some opportunities to get the offense going here, but obviously a bad showing here this week. Lots of questions on a short week. Even more calls for Eli Manning to lose the job, even though they don't really have a good backup plan to Eli Manning. So this is a game where, you know, even if you don't have activity in it, I guess it's a game that going forward, you can kind of take an extra look at both of these teams, see if you can find some reasons to be on or against them. All right, Joe, let's recap what we saw over the weekend here. And we didn't get to the Chargers last week on the show. We had a lot of things that we were trying to cover, and I didn't want to keep Kyle Hunter on hold for too long. So we'll talk about the Chargers here as they pick up the win. First of all, credit to Mike Vrabel. I think going for two was the right call there. Don't take this game to overtime. Go ahead and go for two. See if you can win it. They didn't win it. It is what it is. But I like the ballsiness of that call there from Vrabel. But the Chargers do pull off this win. You know, 10 days on the road, couple of wins. Now they get a little bit of downtime. If it wasn't for the London game, I don't think they would want the bye because of how they're playing right now. But this looks like a team that, you know, has a legitimate chance at being that wild card or maybe even winning this division if Kansas City's defensive shortcomings come to the forefront.
Yeah, and I think, you know, they're sitting there right where they want to be at 5-2. But I agree with you, too. Yeah, you go for the win there. River, you don't give Philip Rivers the ball back is the decision he made there. Rivers was piping hot at the end of that game, like with some of these connections, and that's where he can just get in a rhythm and he doesn't need that much time. I think I forget what it was, 28, maybe 26. I don't care, 20 what. That's enough time for Rivers and those receivers. Right now, Tyrell Williams is a threat. There's something going on between he and Rivers. He's turned into the go-to guy. It's just they've got a great chemistry. He's got too much length in those hands. But another thing, the coaching staff early on figured out something, that Titans coverage. I ended up getting up way too early watching all of that London game, and they had some good information or just scouted the heck out of it, that boiled that film down on their corners playing this inside leverage, and the first play, one deep right to the outside, like they knew it was coming. And like, I don't know, as a corner, why you're trying to work your man, like just leaving the outside open when your help's inside, you play outside. Anyways, I think right now that game early got out of hand. They still could have got caught, though. There's still problems on this defense. It's just I consistently look where they are. I know it doesn't help anybody out to talk about next year, but injury front, what they've sustained already, Hunter Henry is one heck of a tight end. We just won't see him this year. Joey Bosa hasn't played. Verrett, the other corner from TCU, that kid, he's just been marred by injuries. But, yeah, he won't play. That was, I think, one of their best corners. I mean, everyone gives Casey Hayward all the pub, but there's a lot they're playing without. So, it's really, they're doing phenomenal where they are as an organization. And by the way, last week, I'd say one of their best offensive players didn't even play with that late hammy. I think hopefully they get that sorted out, but I think all three of those receivers are playing so well. Keenan Allen's just ridiculous with some of those basketball moves he's making within his routes. The shimmies, it's just hard for any corner to keep up with that improvisation. And Mike Williams, if he could just stay healthy for this whole season, I think it'd be a personal victory for the Chargers organization, just not to get anybody with another season ending injury. But I like Eckler a lot. The low key move in the offseason too, I don't think anybody gave him credit for going out and getting Pouncey at center, but that's rounded their line out. They've finally got some depth, creative play calling, sometimes too creative. A flashback 2 weeks ago, they ran some flea flicker all the way to the wide out back to Rivers, and I just don't like old clubfoot Rivers having to run around on an option like that. That just doesn't make that's bad personnel. But outside of that, I think Kenny Wisenhunt, I'm not nuts about the whole coaching staff, but what Anthony Lynn is doing there, he's surrounded himself with good assistants, and that's how you get it done. You delegate a lot of your work to guys that have been there before and had head coaching jobs before, which is the case with both of these cats. I think they've had some really good wins to their credit, and fortunately they do have some depth in the secondary. The Desmond King, not only has he played well in the absence of Verrett, but they've finally put him at kick returner, and he's not fast. I mean, at Iowa, I don't know if he won the Thorpe Award or not, but, you know, definitely all conference. But he, as a kick returner, just even watching that last game, he just makes the first guy miss so consistently. He's just got a knack for it. This team's got a lot of good going on with it, just as far as good juju. And Joey Bosa eventually will shed that daggone walking boot, and that is, I don't think there's a doubt about it. Outside of Phillip Rivers, that's their best player is Bosa. That's the guy that changes things for game planning flat out. You know, the old saying, coordinators lose sleep. Well, they friggin' do. I mean, Joey Bosa is just the Numenor from Lord of the Rings. Like, he's just like a regular human, just built bigger, faster, stronger. And once that cat gets back there, that's going to change some things for the Chargers. And, yeah, this is another case. So there's an overload finally of talent, and maybe those Chargers, it's finally their season. Unfortunately for people in San Diego, they're going to have to watch it happen. But I like where this team's going. And like you said, they're pouncing on that wild card. And if Kansas City should falter, they're poised right where they want to be.
Well, and of course, the Chargers had 541 yards against Kansas City in week one, badly outgained the Chiefs, but the Chiefs had, you know, a lot of things kind of work out in their favor in that game. Unfortunately, when those two teams play here on December 13th, it's a Thursday night, and it's on the road for the Chargers. So may not be able to put their best foot forward in the rematch against the Chiefs just because of the situational spot. That's another thing to keep in mind here, too. The Chargers still have to play at Pittsburgh, at Kansas City, at Denver. They host Cincinnati. You know, Cincinnati having to come cross country is a little bit of a tough spot for them. But the back of this schedule for the Chargers, particularly in the month of December, very, very daunting. So they should get Bosa back after the bye. Then we'll see what happens with them as they go forward there. But, Joe, let's take a look here at the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And, of course, I watched all of this game going out with some buddies to watch the Browns. And, you know, it was it looked like it had the chance to be a rout in the first half. And obviously it was a 16-2 score going into the intermission. The Browns made some good adjustments. Tampa Bay didn't really adjust all that well, and that kind of speaks to the coaching staff and the problems that they have there, particularly on the defensive side of the ball. Now, in their defense, no Gerald McCoy, no Vinnie Curry. Quan Alexander gets hurt just before halftime. So Tampa Bay was dealing with some pretty significant injuries in this game, but you've talked about defensive concerns for this team for a while.
Oh, yeah, it's in this scapegoat firing. That's just terrible. I think what really happened, you hit it right before the end of half. The worst possible scenario, they may have won this small battle, but the war is lost. Quan Alexander tore his ACL or popped his Achilles, whatever it was. I saw it in slow motion. It something popped in there, and he grabbed the back of that knee like a sniper shot him. I hate to see it because the whole team knows it. Like, they know it's over for him out there for the rest of the season. He's not to his second-year contract yet. This is crushing personally for this kid, and he's one of those spark plugs, man. He's the real leader out there. Alpha dog type. He goes hard all the time. He goes hard in practice. He sets the standard for the young players and the vets. It's just such a unique guy's guy, man. I don't know how else to say it, but it's no coincidence the Browns off. I don't think it was just second half adjustments. I think that that sapped them of a whole lot of confidence. And I just, you know, you lose one of the fastest linebackers in the league. We've said it before, that your defense is going to play slow when you lose that kind of speed. And I love Levante, passion bucket David, but he's not the same player, and they don't have a replacement for Alexander in coverage. McCoy not being out there like you mentioned. Really, Carlton Davis is just getting placed in there. I don't think he's playing well. He may fit whatever scheme they have in mind, but I don't think they've got anything fixed. It's players still. It's not play calls when it boils down to it. And this war of attrition is real for that Bucs defense. They are so going to miss Quan, it's not even funny. I think on that side of the ball, it's already in the books, I guess, with the overs that have been hitting for that side of the ball. I mean, I don't want to dwell on the Bucs, but, I think Jameis did some things well. It's just the bottom lines. They're going to have to outscore a bunch of teams that their defense is going to be in a bad way going forward here. And I guess, I don't know, playing Cincy, that's a defense that could be had. They could probably score on them, and an offense that should hit Tampa up for 30 burger at least. I mean, I really think bad things on the right. As if I had to tell anybody that, but it's not looking good for the Bucs.
No, and the Bucs have missed Quan Alexander before due to injuries and some different things, and they have not played well when Quan Alexander hasn't been out there. And you know, I mean, Levante David's also a guy that has a little bit of an injury history as well. So now you're really on thin ice, and this is a team that didn't have a whole lot of defensive depth anyway, but losing Quan Alexander, certainly a big deal there. I mean, you knew right away the way that the players kind of came together a little bit, that it was a bad state of affairs. And, you know, as we find out, and as we'll probably find out from MRI results, one thing about an ACL is that you generally know pretty quickly. So it certainly seems like that kind of reverberated through the Tampa Bay locker room before they even came out for the second half. And, you know, defensively, they did cave there, especially as the Browns got more plays with Alexander on the sideline. So a different AFC North team here, the Baltimore Ravens. And look, we had the Ravens in the Super Contest. We're finding ways to lose now in this thing. Justin Tucker misses the first extra point of his career. 222 for 222 before that. Misses the PAT. Ravens lose by one in regulation to the Saints. And, of course, you know, they gave up 17 points to the Saints in the fourth quarter of this game. So a game that they should have had in hand, let the Saints come back in the fourth quarter, then miss the PAT, can't even get it to overtime. So for Baltimore, a tough pill to swallow. But, you know, unlike some of the other teams that have had some of these devastating losses here lately, you think Baltimore is still in pretty good shape.
They're a good team, and I don't know about that kick, man. That's the strangest thing. I don't believe in supernatural, but that's one hell of a slice. Something took that ball. And you look at the flags on the post and the crossbars, man, they weren't even moving. The one on the left is glued to the bar. The one on the right's just got a little flicker. So I don't see a crosswind. Something took that ball, and that's why Justin Tucker's eyes almost popped out of his head. I think, are we at Halloween yet? As I was asking myself at that kick. That was a strange-looking kick, but this one's going to sting. And really, I think they're fortunate to be in it. Honestly, that for the start of this game, I'd watch all this. The Saints went on a time-consuming 10-minute drive. I was amazed how fast this game got to halftime because they just sapped the clock. I think it was almost Sean Payton trying to play the Ravens style against them. And that's one thing, almost turn it around on the Saints here. There's some over-experimentation going on. And this Taysom Hill thing is just, I'm pulling my hair out. They're having him run the option at the end of that 10-minute drive, and it was his fault. They think he's this special player, this some multifaceted genius. Well, he's the one that didn't press the interior fender to draw him inside before you make that pitch outside to free up your pitch man. That was poor play, and he's never ran the option at BYU. He's never done it in his career. I don't know why they just think he could just magically figure it out over the course of 2 weeks of practice and play it against one of the best defenses in the league. It's this whole mad scientist Sean Payton thing is going to catch up with him sooner or later, and it burned their bread there. And I think eventually, you know, Taysom Hill is a gunner on special teams. He was injury prone at BYU. He's going to get knocked out. I never wish injury on anybody, but the Saints are just asking for it here because Humpty Dumpty eventually is going to fall off that wall. So that's one freebie for you there. But back to the Ravens, I think just that I like what they've done, the way they've composed this team, this free agent wide receiver core that's panned out real well. I'm a huge personal fan of John Brown, Pittsburgh State. That's Pittsburgh without an H, y'all. Perfect combo with Flacco's deep ball. I mean, when Cool Joe has the time, he can uncork a real nice-looking deep ball. He's just got to get those stork legs right, and once he's pointed up, it's really a nice thing to watch. And John Brown, I think, combos with that so well, and what he does is what Brandon Cooks does for the Rams, you know, like what Josh Gordon's supposed to do for the Pats. It's just that free up the rest of that offense, and I think that's working to some extent. But the move in the offseason, you got to credit Ozzie Newsome. I don't care what he's doing on the field, and maybe he's just running read options, which is also kind of dumb. You're putting Lamar Jackson in there, and basically the entire defense knows it's going to be a run. You know you're not passing, and he's still kind of making it work. But just the presence of him on the roster has forced Joe Flacco into the best shape of his life. I think he's more on point than he's been probably since that Super Bowl run, the miracle run that got him that contract. That was probably the best move the entire offseason outside of getting Wink Martindale from the Broncos. I think what he's done with Eric Weddle and the understanding they have together, he's incorporated Weddle, I think, into the game planning. You watch on the sidelines, they are just attached at the hip, Martindale and the two of them. So I think we already knew this about Eric Weddle. There's a future in coaching if he wants it. He's just such a smart player, and the reason he's been in the league from Utah, he's been in the league for years just because he knows everything. He knows personnel and the defense he hadn't played. And I think the fact of the matter, they still just got two all-timers there on Baltimore, and Weddle and T. Suggs. I don't know how Suggs is playing this well at the end of his career. I hate to put this on somebody, but check him, man. What is he taking? I want some of it. And as long as they got C.J. Mosley, I forget when we did it, but there was a segment we did of, like, non-quarterbacks that I think changed the lines. I think Mosley's one of those types. He's just such a dynamo in coverage. Just, this is a strong team, and I don't know what the look ahead here is, but the Panthers, Ravens, I know that Wink Martindale knows a thing or two about old Norvell Turner. So that's definitely a coaching angle I'd consider going forward. And a Baltimore Ravens team I'm not afraid to back, even after a kind of a little deflating loss. This is still a pro squad, great coaches. They're not going to die easy.
Well, and the Ravens only allowing 4.8 yards per play to that potent New Orleans offense. So, you know, again, a loss, a frustrating one at that, but Baltimore, at least defensively, played really, really well in that game for the most part on Sunday. How about the Jacksonville Jaguars here? I mean, man, I don't even know where to start with this team. I guess we could start with Blake Bortles getting benched and Cody Kessler throwing the ball 30 times. We could talk about how this defense has regressed. We could talk about how Jalen Ramsey's no longer able to run his mouth. I don't know where you start with Jacksonville, but this is a dramatic turnaround. I mean, you're talking about a team that very well should have beaten New England in the AFC Championship game last year, did beat New England this year, and did so in dominating fashion. And since then, it's been a train wreck.
I love Jalen Ramsey. Quiet as a mouse now. So much talk before. You set yourself up for that sometimes. But I hearken to the quote Doc Rivers when he coached the L.A. Clippers. It's not Blake's fault. And that hoarse voice. I mean, I don't want to put this all on Blake. Blake's made some bonehead plays, there's no doubt. But how about two huge drops on third down by Keelan Cole, who had been playing really well. And this bottom line is they're not blocking anybody. You could chalk this whole game up to we can't block Clowney. A.J. Cannon's out of position right now, I think. Parnell's a stiff. And then Josh Walker just shouldn't be out there. I hate to be a jerk, but maybe right now he develops into a player later, but it's just too early. They're missing Cam Robinson so much at left tackle, and I think they're also banged up that Norwell, the big free agent money guy, he's playing hurt. And then they got another, I think Linder, also playing hurt. Both those guys limited on the practice report all last couple of weeks, and that's join the club. No one else can block Clowney either. I don't care if, and it's not – I love how people want to associate this with Leonard Fournette. They don't have their identity, and that's why they traded for Carlos. Hey, bring Jim Brown out there. He ain't blocking Clowney either. Right now, it's just – they're a too volatile team to get behind. I can't back them. And looking ahead, they got Philly. I'm pretty sure they can't block Fletcher Cox or Brandon Graham or Derek Barnett. I'd take an under on that for fact right now if it's 40 or anything. But this team needs a bye week in the worst way, man. And I guess I'd combo this whole game and watched. But, they need to come to Jesus moment. And just before this game, realize they can't block Fletcher Cox. We're going to throw a bunch of digs, screens, dumps, check downs in a hurry-up offense and ditch the run flat out because we can't get it done. If they seriously think they're going to go up against Philly, line up by formation, hat on a hat, man up, they're fooling themselves right now. So, like I said, I don't care who's in that backfield. Adrian Peterson as a rookie, probably going to have problems behind this line. And I think that's the Texans, they may have won this game, man, but they're really shaky up front, and I just hate just listening to these stories about Watson taking that bus instead of the plane due to pressure, air pressure from the flight. I mean, it's that bad, and you're still going through games. That is that's on a whim and a prayer, man. J.J. Watt's got a bad back. Clowney, the trick knee. How long does the honey badger last? This is another team. I'm just throwing out look-aheads here, man. But, they're going to a Broncos in that altitude with Watson and that lung thing? That sounds like a recipe for failure there. This was watching that Texans-Jaguars game, I only watched it on the condensed version, but I'd still like that 30 minutes back.
Ouch. I mean, yeah, I don't blame you, and one of the few good calls I've had recently in the Super Contest was to take Houston this week because of those cluster injuries for Jacksonville. And that's the thing. This Jacksonville defense is still very talented. It is still very good. Deshaun Watson, yes, he's hurt, but 12 of 24 for only 139 yards, but he only got hit once. And that's the problem for Jacksonville right now. They're losing the battle in the trenches very badly week in and week out. They can't block anybody, as you mentioned. They've got a lot of injury concerns, but also, this is a defense that lives on playing that base defense, press coverage. They kind of limit the big plays almost as well as anybody in the league does, but they don't get after the quarterback. So they keep having all these situations on offense where they get these negative plays, get behind the chains. Well, that puts a ton of pressure on your defense when you're not able to flip the field. You're not able to sustain any kind of time of possession. The defense is really being asked to do a ton here for Jacksonville, and it did it last year, but Bortles was at least competent for the most part last year. When Fournette was out there, they were good, but ultimately their offensive line was healthier, and that's the problem for them right now. So as you mentioned, next week, taking on a Philadelphia team that can wreak havoc there in the trenches, doesn't matter if this game is in London or not, if it's a pseudo home game for Jacksonville. I've liked to play Jacksonville in that London game. I think I've done it each of the last 3 years in the Super Contest. There's no way I do it this year. I mean, just what you said, from a matchup standpoint, Jacksonville can't keep a quarterback upright, can't get a push in the running game. How are they going to do it next week against Philadelphia, where the probably the strongest part of the Philadelphia team is that front seven on defense?
They need to seriously do some soul searching, some self scouting, and like I said, I don't want to never want to ditch the run. They always want to say, you know, every coach starts off a press conference where we need to stop the run and really run the ball well. Isn't the goal to win though? Bottom line, at the end of the day, they have to really approach this as more of a pickup basketball game, and things have to happen on an internal clock and quickly. And like I mentioned, just some dumps, check downs are your friends, and test those linebackers, test the secondary on the perimeters. That's where I go. And unfortunately, you're basically asking Blake Bortles to win another game. There's trouble in paradise. That's for sure in Jacksonville.
Joe Everett from Draft Scouts and also Insider Football. Anything you've written here recently that you want to point our listeners towards, or anything that you're working on?
Keys, the coaching search article last week, that is getting finalized. And also the weekly IDP column, we're getting at the halfway point, week 8 on the horizon. It's even more crucial now, more so than ever, to have your bye week replacements. So a waiver wire column that includes 18 defensive players comes in handy. So that's where you want to get it at insiderfootball.com.
I guess last thing I'll ask you about here, Joe, real quickly then, since you mentioned the coaching search thing, in terms of the college guys, Lincoln Riley, maybe Jeff Brohm has kind of put himself into that discussion now as well. Who do you think would be the most likely and then subsequently the most successful college coach to make the leap to the NFL over the next 2-3 years?
You know, I don't think we've heard the last of Chocolate Chip. That's something that still, like, has got to bother him as such a competitive guy. But you took the words right out of my mouth. I think the only reason Lincoln Riley leaves Norman there, is that you don't leave Oklahoma Sooners type job to go to like another Division One unless it's, you know, something prestigious. But I think he's getting meetings with all these NFL guys. All these other coaches want to know why he's so successful. And I think that's half of it. Like, you're not seeing normal offenses as much anymore. And, like, things that used to be trick plays, like these, they call them RPOs, but it's basically your option play with these. That's now a standard and a staple of the offense. And, like, you know, we're basically in the league seeing a lot more big gun offenses, and now a lot of those same results. But yeah, there's a reason a lot of NFL people making the trek out to Norman to talk to Lincoln Riley, because like, he's just changed so many players. That just even what he was doing at East Carolina, just groundbreaking. And there's a big reason why old Bobby Big Game Bob stepped down. It's like there's just too much talent here with Lincoln Riley. Like I need to step right out of the way and let this guy do his thing. And yeah, I would be surprised if he stays in Norman with these flirtations from the league. I think the league's too intrigued. And right now, heck, fans know his name. It'd be a big PR move. Like, well, let's just say it. Tampa Bay, one foot out the door, Dirk Cotter. What about Lincoln Riley? Jameis Winston, Mike Evans, Ronald Jones. That's a lot of firepower for little Lincoln to get started with.
I'm telling you, I mean, I think I said this before Baker Mayfield got drafted, that fit makes a ton of sense in Cleveland. To be back with Baker, you've got a guy in Hugh Jackson who hasn't really proven a whole lot at the NFL level. So that would be the one that I'm kind of thinking. And, of course, as a Clevelander and a quasi-Browns fan, that's the one I'm hoping for. But, man, it should be very interesting to see as we go forward here. Make sure you follow Joe on Twitter, at Joe W. Everett. Joe, appreciate your time, as always. Thank you so much, man. We'll talk to you again next week.
All right, looking forward to it.
Good stuff there with Joe Everett. Again, Draft Scouts and Insider Football, at Joe W. Everett on Twitter. We got one more guest here for this Monday edition of Bang the Book Radio. That is professional handicapper Kyle Hunter from huntersportspicks.com, our Week 9 college football first look. Kyle, how's it going today, man?
It's going all right, man. I have to admit, it's a Monday morning where things feel like that. It's a little bit harder to get going here. Away for the weekend, obviously, I go watch the Buckeyes lose to Purdue, and everybody who listens to the show knows that I'm the big Buckeyes fan, so that was disappointing. But I have to say, it was nice to come back and see that I had done really well for the weekend on my play, so I'll try to look at the positive side of it.
Yeah, we got a lot of stuff to get to here on today's show, and I apologize for that coming out of a weekend away. And you know, I did that a few weekends ago, went to the Kentucky-South Carolina game, drank some bourbon, spent some time with the wife, and it is a challenge to catch up on everything that you missed, make sure that you're going back through the box scores and all that kind of thing. Can be a lot to catch up. It does kind of put you behind a day. So, you know, hopefully that process pretty smooth for you here as you try to get back into everything. But we had a listener question here about college basketball. We had a question about the construction of college basketball power ratings, mentioning that putting together college football power ratings has been very beneficial for them. So, you know, kind of wanted some direction a little bit. This is at DailyG13 on Twitter about college basketball power ratings. So I know that you've got, you know, maybe not the answer necessarily that wants to be heard here on today's show, but you can provide some insight into how to set those things up.
Yeah, I will say that college basketball is a really unique sport in that there's so many teams involved, so many line games. You look at a Wednesday, Thursday, and then a Saturday. You know, there are so many teams. If you want to do power ratings and update them consistently, it's going to take a lot of your time. I would suggest that, you know, if you have a 9-to-5 job, if you're doing something else, if you want to do power ratings, I think it's better to probably just do it for one conference or some one specific area that you know better. We talk about specialization quite a bit. It's hard to do a good job with power ratings in a small amount of time. One thing that I decided to do for myself last year is I decided to stop doing college basketball power ratings based on the fact that the majority of my plays were on totals anyways, and, you know, my sides hadn't been doing well. So I was spending a bunch of time on college basketball power ratings, and it really wasn't helping me at all. So last year I decided I would just start using averages of ones that were widely available, and there are quite a few of them out there. You can look at Sagarin, you can look at Sonny Moore, Massey, those types of places where you can get a guide. So what I kind of do is I look at a rolling average of power ratings, and then I try to look at situational spots, matchup advantages when it comes to playing sides now. Last year, that worked out really well for me. I was able to spend a lot more time, you know, honing in my totals expertise, and that's where I know the market's the most inefficient. So, you know, if I'm taking 90% of my plays and making them in the totals market, then it makes more sense for me to spend my time there. I'm going to continue to do that. I think that it's a lot harder to update college basketball power ratings than it is college football. You think about the fact that how often a college basketball team plays, you know, realistically you're not going to be able to update those consistently. You probably want to take once a week to update those if you're doing them on your own. Thing I will say, you know, a general rule, you have to assign a point value to a position the same way you do in college football. So even though I'm not doing them now, I'll kind of just give a general guideline that point guard and center should be worth more, in my opinion, than the other spots on the floor. And then you also have to weight the coach position quite a bit as well. So, you know, say you're weighting everything 15 points. Maybe you want the point guard and the center to be worth 20. And keep in mind, if you're doing college basketball power ratings as well, there are going to be some drastic differences from one conference to another. You may have one team power rated, 89 or 90, and if you're power rating all the way down to a SWAC team, you may have a 29, a 30. You know, there's going to be some huge wide range there. So maybe not the perfect answer, but, you know, to be transparent, that's the way I'm doing things now.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, you know, we're talking about, I think it's what, 353 Division I teams this year, I think. I think they added two from last year. So, you know, I mean, and they play 2-3 times a week. Or if you've got, you know, the preseason tournaments or something like that, you know, maybe they're playing 4 games there early on. It's easy to update college football or NFL power ratings because they play once a week. So, you know, that's one thing that you really want to keep in mind is that it's probably not the most efficient use of your time. So I agree with what Kyle's saying there about, you know, trying to get an average of all the available ones that are out there. Obviously, you can go to, you know, something like KenPom, but of course, keep in mind, the books use KenPom very heavily as well. somebody like a Bart Torvik does a good job with work out there. You know, you mentioned Massey and Sagarin and Sonny Moore and some of the other ones that are out there. I think that's the smartest thing to do, honestly, is get yourself together a spreadsheet that sort of aggregates all of them. Then you come up with an average. That way, you know, you can set it up to scrape data when they update, because it's just hard to do, especially if you're not somebody who does this full time or you're not somebody that's exclusively a college basketball handicapper. I don't know how the hell you would do it with college football going on, NFL, NBA. You know, there's so many things going on that require your time to update 353 teams. So I like what you said, too. Conference specialization, very important. We'll talk about that a lot when we get into our handicapping the hardwood college basketball segments here, because there are 353 teams. Narrow it down to a conference with 12 or 14 teams. You know, do a couple of those, power rate those, become an expert in those, especially if they're under the radar conferences where the lines aren't going to be as tight, the market's not going to be as efficient. That would be my recommendation, and it certainly sounds like that would be yours as well.
I do think that's a great way to do it. And then you can use your numbers and then compare them up against somebody else. Now, I think it's fair to say different people have different scales. There are also different people who use a 0 to, you know, minus 15 or 0 to minus whatever and then a plus. You know, they try to – I'm honestly not exactly sure how they do it. But, you know, you can see some certain people that will do power ratings that are – you know, an average of what a team is overall for the year, and then, you know, take a minus 15, a minus 17 for the best team, and then plus whatever for the worst team. You know, there are different ways of doing this, so you got to keep in mind when you're using your power ratings and you try to go up against somebody else's, it may not be an apples-to-apples comparison, but it still gives you a general rule. As Adam just said there, the biggest thing for me was spending that much time on it for sides when really totals are my specialty. And second, there's a lot of overlap at the beginning of the college basketball season. No doubt this period coming up here from early November through early January, easily my busiest time of the year. And it's hard for me to justify spending a bunch of time on college basketball power ratings when college football's not over and the NFL's not over, the NBA is going on. You know, college football and the NFL still are the most important sports in this industry. You know, that's where you're going to get more buyers. That's where most people are paying attention. I can't justify spending a ton of time updating the college basketball power ratings all the time and sacrificing something in those sports. So, to me, it was a time issue. If I was just a college basketball handicapper, I would definitely still be doing that.
Yeah, and I mean, again, you know, you talk about turnover, you talk about attrition, you talk about, you know, transfers, so many transfers in the world of college basketball, too, that, you know, even going off of last year's power ratings, there's really not a great foundation for that, because you know, you've got one-and-dones with all the major conference teams, you've got, you know, some teams in the MAC or in the Sun Belt or something that lose, you know, leading scorer or senior, you're going to have to drop them significantly in hopes that, you know, you're right there with the market. It's just, it's one of those things where it's really, really challenging unless you are, as you said, a full-time college basketball handicapper. So, again, if you want to do it, if you want to take up, you know, that type of project, like Kyle said, you know, you do basically the same thing that we do with college football, where you take the position groups, you kind of rate them a little bit, weight them accordingly based on the importance of those positions, and then coaching, as you mentioned, a really significant deal in college basketball. So, all right, let's transition back to the college football side of things here a little bit. And, you know, I don't think you and I need to spend a ton of time talking about Ohio State, because I mean, everybody kind of got to watch what was going on with this team. This was building, and they do this in the middle of the year. They have a bunch of flaws, and then all of a sudden it all comes to a head, and they get blown out by a team that shouldn't blow them out. Credit to Purdue, who I think is a very, very impressive team, getting much better as the season goes along. But, you know, I got to watch this one drinking Great Lakes Oktoberfest sitting on my couch. You got to watch this one by also freezing your nuts off. So I imagine you've got some takes on how this one played out.
Yeah. Fortunately, I dressed warm enough that it wasn't as bad as it maybe looked, but the wind was the worst. I have to say, anybody who took the under in that game and had under 67, under 68, whatever, brutal loss. I mean, it's just a terrible loss. We were walking out of the stadium as we heard the pick six happen. And I said to my wife, oh, my gosh, I feel so bad for the people that took the under. I should have never lost that one. But, you know, in general, Ohio State got what they deserved in that game. I mean, they did not deserve to win that game. Purdue deserved to win it. I think as a Buckeyes fan, the most disappointing thing was how Ohio State played late in that game. You know, they came down and scored and made it a, you know, whatever it was, 2-touchdown game. And the defense, which had been stopping the run so consistently, just started giving up, you know, gaping holes, and they were just running right down the field easily. To me, it's 2 years in a row where this happened last year against Iowa. You could say it happened before that against Clemson, but at least Clemson was a really good team. Then you see that happening against Iowa, and now you see it happening against Purdue. It seems like, late in the games that Ohio State's losing, they just, you know, unravel completely. I know that, I hate to use the word quit, but it didn't look like they were, you know, giving their best effort out there, that's for sure. They're missing some sort of leadership here, and, you know, I'm starting to wonder at least a little bit, you know, about Urban Meyer and his coaching staff. You know, maybe they're not what they used to be. Ohio State certainly still has the talent. You know, we can't say that Ohio State doesn't recruit well enough or they don't have the guys that could get them in that spot. We know they recruit really well every single year. So it's not a shortage of talent. I have to say, on the other side, you know, Jeff Baum and Nick Holt, a really, really good coaching duo. I think that they're still underrated by most people. I imagine, you know, this will wake people up a decent amount based on this game. But I thought that in general, Ohio State, you know, just played really poorly as a team. The penalties were ridiculous for quite a while. Some of the ways that, you know, when they come down and score in the second half and make it 14-6, and then that drive where we had a roughing the punter to keep it alive, and then it was 21-6 before you know it. That was a really, really big turn in the game. You know, Ohio State moved down the field easily to start the second half, kicked another field goal, which obviously the red zone offense was a big problem as well. But, you know, I will say that, you know, the Purdue fans were very reasonable compared to some other road fans that, you know, you can see throughout college football. And you know, they deserve that win. And the Buckeyes weren't going to win the national title anyways. You know, that's what the few Purdue fans who had anything to say as we were leaving were kind of just like, hey, you're not going to win the national title now. You know, jokingly, my comment back was, neither are you. But seriously, I said, you know, we weren't going to win the national title anyways. I mean, it was – this team had too many flaws. There's no way they were going to beat everybody. So it was going to happen. Unfortunately, it happened when we went. But, you know, it is what it is.
Well, I mean, and like I said on Twitter, I mean, at this point, just beat that team up north and then destroy whoever you play in the Rose Bowl, because the Pac-12 is not very good. So Ohio State should have the upper hand in the Rose Bowl if they got to that point. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of football left to go. Who knows what could end up happening? But, you know, the coaching thing is fascinating to me because, and I've been telling people this over the last few days, Ohio State's not going to be Alabama. Nobody's going to be Alabama. No one's going to beat Alabama either. But with the talent that's in this program, there is no excuse for Ohio State to not be on Clemson's level every year, on Oklahoma's level every year, Georgia's level every year. There's just no excuse for that. And this team, while you had to respect them from a power rating standpoint because, you know, they're going to get big numbers in Big Ten play, they weren't on the level of any of those teams this year. And it was clear from the start. And the few things that really concerned me the most about this game were, number one, Purdue looked faster. Purdue looked more athletic. They looked faster. They looked a lot more engaged, which, I mean, obviously with the way the final score showed up, not really a big surprise for that. But the athletic gap between Ohio State and Purdue looked so small, almost non-existent in this game. And maybe Rondale Moore has something to do with that. But even Purdue's, yeah, you know, linemen catching Dwayne Haskins, or their linebackers running down Weber or Dobbins or Campbell when he was on jet sweep, something like that, that bothered the hell out of me. Because the one advantage Ohio State has always had is its athleticism. It's faster, it's quicker than any other team in the Big Ten. Well, Jeff Brohm and Nick Holt are building a fast team there in West Lafayette, and that really concerned me from an Ohio State standpoint. And the other thing that I was thinking about, and you know, you sent me a great article, and I'll share this on Twitter after the show from the Cleveland Plain Dealer, Cleveland.com, is that for Ohio State here, a lot of nepotistic hires. I don't even know if that's a word, but I'm going to make it one. A lot of nepotistic hires for Urban Meyer here. You know, even you'll get going back to Zach Smith, you know, a guy that was there because he was of the lineage of Earl Bruce, didn't really seem to have any reason to have a job there at Ohio State. Then he's well protected, well insulated. Obviously, we all know how that situation kind of came down. But, you know, a lot of yes men in this program for Urban Meyer. And then also, I think there are just too many cooks in the kitchen. You basically have co-OCs in Ryan Day and Urban Meyer, who wants his say, co-DCs in Greg Schiano, who should be fired, and Alex Grinch, who came over from Washington State. You've got a lot of budding egos here that all have to be subservient to Urban Meyer and be yes men. I think there's a big continuity problem with this team, and it shows up in how poorly prepared they are for all of these big marquee games that they play. There are not many times during Urban Meyer's tenure at Ohio State where they've come out and looked like they were clearly the better team in spots where they should be, or looked like a team that was ready to go against comparable competition. So there are a lot of problems here with this coaching staff. It's unraveling. It's coming down to the players here. And you kind of wonder going forward, what changes? What can change? They're not firing Urban Meyer. Urban Meyer has to retire from this position for him to no longer be the coach at Ohio State. And obviously we saw that with everything that happened here earlier on this year. So what changes? When does it change? How does it change? I don't know. I think Ohio State is going to be a top five power rated team that doesn't win a national championship anytime soon. And that's remarkably frustrating and disappointing for a program that has this kind of talent.
Yeah, I know some people are wondering aloud if, you know, Urban Meyer, based on his some people think he was disappointed with how the university treated him. Maybe he'll just leave at the end of this season, or maybe he'll be gone in the next couple of years. Wouldn't shock me. Wouldn't totally surprise me. I have to be honest, I have no idea. You know, I really don't know what's going to happen on that. I agree with the assistant coaches. You know, a few years ago, they had the best assistant coaches in the business, and I don't think there was even a question. And you kind of just assume they're going to continue to have good assistant coaches. You know, Urban Meyer should be able to get really top-notch guys, and you start realizing one by one that these guys aren't as good. You know, like you said, maybe there's just too many of them. You know, I was pretty excited when they brought over Alex Grinch to help with the defense, but that hasn't worked out. Maybe, like you said, maybe it hasn't worked out because Greg Schiano was already there. Too many cooks in the kitchen type thing. I agree with you that that could be a problem. Ohio State's a supremely talented team who could beat anybody on any day except for Bama. They wouldn't beat Bama right now. But, I mean, they're a really good team. And, you know, if they bounce back and have some huge wins here coming up soon, I'm not going to be surprised. But, you know, going forward until they can prove that they're not going to have a game like they did this past weekend, you have to keep that in your mind.
And look, I mean, they control their own destiny. If they run the table, they're in the college football playoff. Even with this ugly loss to Purdue, they just are, because they'll play maybe a ranked Michigan State team. They'll certainly play that team up north when they're ranked in a huge game. You know, whoever comes out of the West is going to be ranked, whether it's Purdue at this point or Iowa or Wisconsin, whatever else. They'll have the body of work. You know, they'll have the wins that it takes. And again, brand name. Like I said, I mean, I do kind of wonder, maybe the college football playoff committee keeps Ohio State out of the playoff as punishment to the university for not letting Urban Meyer go. That's the only thing that keeps them out if they run the table. But again, this doesn't look like a team currently capable of running the table. So, you know, we'll see how they bounce back. We'll see how things go for them going forward here. But again, a very significant loss, one that we could kind of see coming, and one that should keep them out of the college football playoff. But, you know, we'll see how things play out the rest of the way. All right, so let's talk about the rest of the weekend around college football. Again, we've had a lot of top 10 teams going down over the last 3 weeks. But, you know, you had a good weekend in football, and I think it kind of goes in concert with the fact that the under, very good last weekend.
Yeah, you know, the unders didn't do quite as well for me as what I was hoping, to be honest with you, although, you know, my overs went 0-2 on Saturday, so that hurt also. I had the NC State and Clemson over as my top play. That one ended up a little bit short because NC State couldn't help at all. But unders did really well overall in college football. I was 3-0 in the NFL yesterday, and essentially what happened was I was 6-5 in college football over the course of the weekend, and 6-0 in all the other sports. So, you know, it was an interesting weekend. The under was 32-22 in college football on Saturday. Listen, don't let anybody tell you that high winds don't matter very much. I've heard some people who, you know, have a pretty widely available opinion talk about that, you know, the wind is overvalued. That's not true. The under has gone about 64% in the last 10 years with winds of 20 miles per hour or greater. And keep in mind also that when I'm quoting these numbers, this is from the closing line. And if you watch the lines, you can go back and look at the line history from this past weekend. These games went way down before before the close. So, you know, if the line opened at, you know, 52, in some cases, you know, that thing was 44 by the kickoff, and they still went 33 and 22 to the under overall. Now, obviously, there were plenty of games that weren't the weather games, but in the Midwest, when you have as much wind as there was, and I will say, you know, from experience, the wind was really bad on Saturday. When there's as much weather as there is in the Midwest, there's a lot of games being played there. So it makes a big difference. Pay very close attention to the weather. I think it's fair to say that you could overvalue what the wind means in the NFL if you're talking about 10 or 12 miles per hour wind. NFL quarterbacks would have an easier time, you know, stronger arms, better play calling probably. They're more better suited, I would say, to be able to handle that. But in college, I think it makes a huge deal. And it's something to keep in mind moving forward that, you know, by Thursday, a couple days before the game, these lines are going to start moving based on the weather forecast. So it's probably also something that you don't want to wait till Saturday morning to do.
Well, you know, I mean, you talk about the wind being bad. So naturally, Ohio State threw the ball 73 times and had 25 running plays. So, you know, I mean, but I mean, that was a game that was a stone cold under too until the fourth quarter where things got absolutely crazy. So the under should have even done a little bit better there with the wind, but that's definitely a very important thing to keep in mind as weather continues to get worse. And again, keep in mind, you talk about the Mountain West, you're going to have wind and snow, and you've got some California teams. They're going to have to go play in snow or an altitude or something like that. They're already going to be miserable. They're not going to want to go out there and play. So you're going to have some of those games here as well, where you've got teams going to cooler weather places just because of, you know, you got Texas teams maybe going up and playing in Huntington, West Virginia, in Conference USA or something like that. You know, keep that in mind here too, where, you know, you're going to have wind, you're going to have precipitation, you're going to have teams making long travel to places they don't really want to go. And also you may end up having some travel concerns if we get some snowstorms here in November and things of that sort. But another thing to keep in mind here at this time of the year, and, you know, these are really, I think, areas where you can get some edges because the market is very, very tight. I posted my updated power ratings this morning. Lots of games within a point or two of my numbers, the vast majority of them really. Very, very tight here at this time of the year, but situational angles become a lot more relevant because you've got weeknight Fun Belt, as we'll talk about here in a little bit, and then Maction starts basically this week. You've got some Thursday games, but next week we start to get Tuesday, Wednesday games, so you're going to have a lot of rest spots you can maybe look to take advantage of. I know there's one you wanted to touch on here on today's show.
Yeah, the first one is you know, the disadvantage of playing in a short week. You're not going to see this very often because usually they schedule it to where both teams are on similar rest. But keep an eye out for this one. Interesting one for certain. Teams with 6 days or less between games going against a team playing 7 days or more between games, 84 and 119 with five pushes since 2007. So 41.4% ATS. If you're a favorite at that position in that spot, 39.8% ATS. So you look to go against a team that has the rest disadvantage in these you know, weekday games, and you would do well. Having said that, you know, it's hard to find these spots. You won't find them very much. I honestly don't look to see if there's any of them on this week's card. It wouldn't surprise me since there's so many weeknight games, but look for those spots where you have a team with, you know, that just played 5 days ago or 6 days ago against a team that's, you know, played 7 or 8 days ago. It won't happen too often, but it's certainly something to keep an eye on.
This is one that astounds me here. As you listen to our notes, some short week ATS stats here, 6 days or less between games for both teams. underdogs, 53% against the number. Dogs of four or more, 55% against the number. So again, that's when both teams are on 6 days or fewer of rest. What do you attribute that to?
It probably just less predictability, less, you know, the team that is the better team doesn't have quite the same advantage, or the team that, you know, you're expecting to win, it's a little bit less predictable. That's all I could go with. I will say it's interesting to think about, because you would think that on a shorter rest, you try to sit there and figure out, who does this help? Does this help the team with the coach that's really good? But yet the team with the coach that's really good usually does very well when they have a long time to prep. So I think that's a tricky question as well. I'm curious to get your take on, you know, coaching, like a coaching advantage. Does a coaching advantage mean less in a spot like that?
Yeah, I mean, I would think so, you know, but at the same time, a lot of times these underdogs are going to be traveling. So you basically get what, maybe, you know, you don't do much on Sunday coming off of a game. Monday, you'll get a full practice in. Tuesday, you'll get a full practice in. Wednesday, maybe you do some kind of walkthrough, then travel to where you're playing on Thursday. And of course, I'm just using the Thursday night example. It's even different if you're playing Wednesday to Tuesday in Maction or something like that. But you know, that's the thing that's weird for me, is that usually the underdog going to be the road team, less time to practice, less time to prep, less time to really do everything. So maybe it's just, excuse me. I don't know. Maybe the favorite's too much expectation. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it makes for a unique spot, and I think it's certainly interesting. The sample size here is pretty large, so I think it's certainly something to keep an eye on here for the 53% underdogs since 2005 and 4 points or more at 55%. One thing I'll add in here is, if you're fading the public in this spot, now, I think that this can be overvalued. You know, I don't want to be a guy that just says, you know, you fade the public, you're going to make a bunch of money. I think the public's smarter than they used to be. But I still think that, you know, on these games with a large handle, these weeknight games where the public doesn't know very much about these teams, so that they say, oh, yeah, you know, I remember Appalachian State from last year. You know, they were a good team. Or I remember they won their bowl game last year. And we talk about that in college basketball, and that'll be something we talk about moving forward, that the last thing you remember from that team from last year, sometimes a public bettor will just, I'm putting my money on this side. So I think what that does is it inflates the line a little bit on the bigger name team. These weeknight games are really interesting in that if you just took the team, you backed a team with less than 50% of the overall bets, it's 228 and 179 ATS, so 56%. The larger handle on these games, fading the public, makes sense to me. I think that, you know, you're probably going to catch an extra couple points. You know, you get a spot where maybe a team should be catching 6.5 points and you're getting 7.5 or 8 across the key number. I think it's something certainly to keep in mind.
Well, and we will have one of those games here, possibly, that applies to both of these trends here, with 6 days or fewer between games for both teams, with the dogs and fade the public. We'll talk about that game here in a few minutes. Before we get to that, real quick, we've been talking about some teams in line for regression. We've got a couple of SEC teams here on today's show that you want to discuss.
Yeah, Vanderbilt's offense first. They're 54th in the nation in yards per play, only 112th in points per game. And look, sir, this is not a straight, you know, I wouldn't predict that they'd go to 54th YPP and also 54th in points per game. Vanderbilt plays slowly, so that's going to skew the number a little bit. But, you know, they've only scored on 19 out of 29 trips into the red zone, 65.52%. That's last in the nation. That should regress to the mean. Only a touchdown on 48% of the red zone trips. They're also 112th in the nation in third down offense at only 33.66%. I'm not saying that I think this Vanderbilt offense is tremendous, but I do think we should see some positive regression coming for them.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, Vanderbilt, they're an interesting team. They started out pretty strong. A lot of people kind of getting on board with the Commodores. I don't want to say train because they're the Commodores. So with the Commodores ship there, but then they ran into some really tough matchups. They kind of got beaten up a little bit. You know, they played very admirably in that game where they didn't cover against Florida. Pretty admirable showing here against Kentucky this past weekend as well. So maybe the buy sign is on for Vanderbilt a little bit. And in fact, as you look out there in the betting market here today, the market really not comfortable with making Arkansas a home favorite against an SEC team, because now Vanderbilt's gone from a 2.5-point dog to a 1-point favorite on the road. Some of that possibly being that positive regression that you're looking for.
Yeah, I think that's certainly possible. On the negative side, I think Kentucky's defense, I'm not saying I don't think Kentucky's defense is good, but I don't think Kentucky's defense is as good as everybody thinks they are right now. They're second in the nation in points per game allowed, 13th in yards per play allowed. But look at who Kentucky's played so far this year, and then also look at the circumstances it's been in. And I think it's important to keep in mind that statistics can only tell you so much. You know, you look at stats. I love stats. You know, I'm definitely a big stats guy, analytical mind. You know, that's how my mind works. Yet you have to say sometimes the stats will lie to you too. You know, you have to look at it from a context position. So I think Kentucky, if you look at who they've played, they haven't really played that many good offenses. None of them are great. Texas A&M had some big-time turnover issues, which held down their point total against them. And then Vanderbilt and Kentucky played in strong wind this last weekend. I think Kentucky's defense has been in quite a few favorable spots. If you look at who they're playing coming up, I think Kentucky's going to start giving up more points here. So whether you want to say you would look to go against Kentucky or you want to play an over with Kentucky, I think those are both fair, although I will say, and I know I have some insight on this one as well, I think Kentucky's passing game on offense is so weak that you better hope Kentucky can run the ball if you want the over backing Kentucky, because their passing game is extremely weak.
Yeah, I know Wynn played a factor against Vanderbilt, but 3 of 9 for 18 yards last week in that game. And Terry Wilson's not a good quarterback. I mean, I mentioned this from the South Carolina game I was at, and then didn't play very well in that game against Texas A&M either. But they have no semblance of a passing game. I mean, his high in passing yards this season, 163 against Murray State. They can't throw the football. Wow. And this is a team that I want to fade really badly. And I will fade them when Georgia goes to Lexington here on November 3rd. I almost don't care what the number is, because that's the game where I think they get exposed. But this week, they're at Missouri with a good running game, a really solid defense, as a top 15 team in the country, and they're a 7-point dog. And I don't think a whole lot of Missouri here this season. I thought they've been overrated since the start. I've kind of had them in line with the market from a power rating standpoint, even though I don't necessarily agree. Missouri's a 7-point favorite here this week. I thought this would be a spot I'd be able to go against Kentucky, and my number is only 4, and I've been low on the Wildcats to begin with. So, you know, someone's going to expose Kentucky very, very soon. I don't know if it's Missouri this week. I don't know if it's Georgia November 3rd. I think it is. Probably not going to be Tennessee. But because they, you know, get – if they run the table here in the SEC and play Alabama, good Lord, that's going to be a blowout of extreme proportions in the SEC championship game. So no knock on Kentucky, and I got a good buddy who's a Kentucky alum and certainly a big fan. I kind of hope they lose, just because I don't want to see them get exposed in the spotlight losing by 60 to Alabama.
Yeah, I agree. I actually kind of root for Kentucky personally, but yeah, I hope they lose one of those games. I don't want to see that Kentucky-Alabama matchup, and I think that it is fair to say also that I thought that I might get a chance to go against Kentucky this week with Missouri, but there's no way I could lay 7 points.
All right, let's look at some of these games here for this week. And as I mentioned, we've got some Fun Belt action here. Weeknight Fun Belt. Tuesday night, Troy and South Alabama, game 101-102. First one right here on the board. And, you know, Kyle, the three games that we're going to talk about here on the segment, Troy, South Alabama, Appalachian State, Georgia Southern, Georgia Tech, Virginia Tech, all very important for a variety of different reasons. I don't have any power ratings value on any of those three games, but there are some compelling situational arguments to be made about all three of them. Beginning with this one, you know, Troy lost to Liberty, and Troy was playing this first game without Caleb Barker. Not a big surprise to see the offense struggle a little bit, but it is crucially important at this time of the year to put these games in the proper context. That game did not mean a damn thing for Troy. So as we see this line go from 10 to 11.5, it does seem like it opened a little bit low because of that Troy loss. But you got to keep in mind, that game meant nothing to the Trojans.
Yeah, and the second thing about this game, as far as situational handicapping, is Troy last year lost to South Bama 19-8 after Troy beat LSU the previous game. That was a huge letdown spot for Troy last year. South Bama got them, and Troy with the chance for revenge in this game. So I think the line move makes sense to me. The quarterback spot for Troy is certainly a question mark. There's no doubt about that. This South Bama team has some very, very significant injury issues. They've got a lot of key players on the defensive end that have been banged up. Looks like some of those guys might play this coming week. But, this is a South Bama team that is pretty limited. You know, they're throwing the ball more often here of late. South Bama's defense has been really weak this year, giving up 6.37 yards per play. They also haven't played a tough schedule at all. Not that Troy has really played a really tough schedule, but they did go to Nebraska and win. Nebraska certainly playing better of late. At that point, Nebraska wasn't playing very well. But, you know, I think the spot here favors Troy based on last year and based on the fact that people are getting down on them a bit from the last game, like you said. It would be Troy or nothing for me here, but I don't think I'll play this game.
Yeah, it would be Troy or nothing for me. I mean, at 10, I would have considered it. At 11.5, it falls right on my number. In fact, it looks like this number is on the move out there in the marketplace as we're talking right now with what looks like some Troy money starting to hit the board. So, again, makes some sense here because, look, when you're in the Sun Belt, two things matter to you. Knocking off a premier Power 5 conference team when you play one of those paycheck games like Troy did last year against LSU or like Appalachian State this year against Penn State and winning the Sun Belt. And now that you've got a conference championship game, and Troy's in the tough side of the division here, not a big surprise that they would kind of punt that game a little bit last week, try to figure out some different things here with their offense because their remaining five games in the regular season are the ones that matter. As their two biggest tests, Georgia Southern and Appalachian State, both on the road. So if you're Neil Brown, you've got this road game here. Yes, it's an inferior opponent, but it's a revenge game. You didn't play well in the last game. And you tell your team, hey, boys, look, our two biggest games are on the road. Let's make it a point to win this game on the road. And for South Alabama, they don't really have much to concern themselves with here. Their only wins, Texas State and Alabama State, they've given up 52 to Memphis, 52 to Appalachian State, 48 to Georgia Southern. So, Troy is a superior team here. This line opened a little bit low. Now it's on the move. The market's correcting it. It's 12.5 now and up to 13 as I'm talking. So this is probably the right side here. It is Troy or nothing. But again, now you're getting the worst of the number.
Yeah, I mean, and as far as the total here, I wouldn't know what to do with the total either. I don't really have a fair projection of what it's going to be based on my weekend and my amount of prep I've done yet. But I will say, this is a game where I couldn't play the total either. I think that, South Bama is a team that has been so bad on defense. At the same time, Troy's defense is very good. Troy has questions on offense. This line's certainly on the move right as we talk. I don't know, Adam, maybe you were moving the line just by talking right there. But this is an interesting spot where it's gone from 11.5, and now we're looking at 13. It looks like we may even see our 13.5 here pretty soon. It's just ironic the line moved and what time they came at.
Yeah, for sure. And it's been pretty light on line moves out there in the market so far because, as I mentioned, the market is very efficient at this point in time. But we will start to see some of those syndicates release, and I'm guessing that's probably what that move is there for Tuesday night's game. We'll stay in the Sun Belt here. Let's go to Thursday, game 109-110, Appalachian State, Georgia Southern. First thing I want to ask you about, before we dig too far into this game, you've got a position for Georgia Southern to win the Sun Belt. I know Rolf Michaels has one as well, so I'll be asking him the same question here. I think you played Georgia Southern's win total over as well. Are you making any kind of hedge in this situation?
I haven't thought too hard about this game yet. I have to say, I wish I put more on Georgia Southern before the season. It ended up being a small position for me. By the time I got to the win total, I ended up passing on it because of the juice. So I don't have a win total. I just have them to win the Sun Belt. To me, Georgia Southern is a much improved team, but it's a big ask of them to beat App State here. App State's defense is very strong against the run. 10th in the nation, yards per rush allowed. And, you know, to be fair, App State has played a pretty good schedule, especially when you compare it to Georgia Southern's schedule played so far this year. So Georgia Southern can't throw. We all know that. They're going to run every single time, just about every single time. It looks like they're running on almost 88% of their plays this year, which is second most in the country. So we know what Georgia Southern is going to do. They're also going to try to slow the tempo down. They're easily the slowest-paced team in the country. Georgia Southern's first in the nation in turnover margin. I have to say, even though I like Georgia Southern, I think that they've been a little bit fortunate so far this year. So, yes, I would think that I will do some sort of hedge in this game. How I do that, I'm not exactly sure yet. Appalachian State, the more complete team. Appalachian State has proven at this point that they have a good offense and a good defense. They can also run or pass. I think it should be pointed out that the forecast for this game right now is pretty interesting. I know it's 3 days away, but it's calling for 10 to 15 miles per hour and some rain during the game. So if you get rain and wind, it's kind of an equalizer. So, you know, I think that might help Georgia Southern a little bit, though. I will say with the option, you can see some turnovers in that kind of situation as well. So a complex handicap here. I think this line's about right. You know, my lean would probably be the under in this game. I think that App State will probably do a pretty good job stopping the run. I also think that Georgia Southern will, you know, control the tempo enough to where this one would probably be relatively low scoring.
Yeah, my number is 7.5 here, so I don't really have any value. We're not crossing any key numbers or anything like that. Complex handicap is the best way to describe this game because also App State on a short week against the option. And we all know that that's a very bad place to be in because, you know, I mean, it's tough to game plan. Now, they do see it every year, which does help them a little bit. But, you know, again, short week, option prep. Also, with Appalachian State, I kind of wonder. You know, I mean, Zach Thomas has played well. He hasn't had to do a whole lot because they've been able to run the football kind of down everybody's throat. But, you know, now you don't have Jalen Moore. And, you know, last week, I mean, I got to give it credit. Darrington Evans was fantastic last week, had 183 yards on the ground on 26 carries. Appalachian State, though, never pulled away from Louisiana. My line in the market right now is off on Louisiana, so maybe I just haven't been paying enough attention to the Raging Cajuns. But you sort of wonder, you know, is Appalachian State capable of going out there and maximizing the low number of possessions they're going to have in this game? Did they look ahead last week? Because that was a huge sandwich spot. Arkansas State, probably the team that's going to represent the West in the Sun Belt title game. Georgia Southern on deck. Start of three straight road games for App State here. Was that just a flat spot last week, or does this team maybe have some problems? So I don't. I really don't think there's anything I can do with the side here. I agree with your total position, depending on what we see from the number here. But this is a complex handicap, and it concerns me because the public knows Appalachian State. You know, they played right with Penn State. They've been that team in the Sun Belt, one of the best group of fives for the last several years. It worries me that the public may be very one-sided on the Mountaineers here, and I think there are a lot of considerations. So, again, maybe one of the best things you can do sometimes in college football is not bet a loser. And maybe, I don't, not to say that Appalachian State can't cover here, but, you know, I'm glad we're able to talk about a game like this and inform our audience and have them pass it on to their friends, too, that, you know, just because you know Appalachian State doesn't mean you want to play them here this week.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Now, one more point I want to point out here is that definitely the public is going to take App State in this game. You see 68% of the bets so far have been on Appalachian State, and the lines moved down. So that tells you quite a bit. I think that this will be a split as far as the public versus sharp money. I think if I had to take a side, I would probably take Georgia Southern here plus the points. Having said that, it's definitely not a strong lean. And you'll definitely want to check the weather forecast as we get closer to the game.
So we talk about playing the option on a short week and how that can be a problem for you. Virginia Tech gets the option on extra prep time here this week. Georgia Tech in Blacksburg. This is your ACC Thursday night showcase game. This number is down from 4.5 to 3.5, though. With Vatek having extra prep time for the option, we talk about context clues in the betting market. We talk about, you know, kind of reading the tea leaves, so to speak. This isn't a significant move crossing the number of 4, but it got my attention right away.
Yeah, and it's also a spot where more of the bets have been on the percentage of bets on Virginia Tech is 61%, and yet the line's moved the other way. So certainly interesting. You know, I would have Georgia Tech as more of a play-on team than Virginia Tech at this point as well. Although I don't think that, you know, as I update my PRs, I don't think that this is going to be showing any line value for me at 3.5. So another game where I think what you said earlier is going to be true, that there are a lot of games really close to the line that I would have put them at. So, you know, you're going to be either playing a smaller amount of games as far as sides or pushing your edge a little bit more than you had to before, or else you probably won't come up with too many here. I think that, you know, Georgia Tech's a team that we know what they're going to do. And Georgia Tech's defense has been a problem. You know, they give up too many big plays. Virginia Tech, I don't know what to make of this team. You know, it's hard for me to say this because you feel like you should never say in week 9 you don't really know what to make of a team. But I really do think that's kind of fair to say about Virginia Tech right now. I mean, they've been so back and forth, up and down. It's hard to know what to make of them. I think that, you know, Virginia Tech has been a team that's dealt with quite a few injuries and then dismissals of key players. You know, to be fair, though, I don't know that Virginia Tech's injury at quarterback in Josh Jackson, you know, is it really a big step down? You know, it hasn't really proved out to be that, at least so far. And I think it's also important to point out that Trevante Benson has been out for Georgia Tech for quite a while now. He's out for the season. He was really a key runner in this backfield. Now, they have really good depth, and they're still going to be able to run the football pretty well, but he's been a key injury for them. I don't know what to do with this game. This is going to be a pass game for me as well.
Yeah, I mean, this one's pretty much almost on my number. I've got Virginia Tech 4 here, but, you know, when you look at these two teams and the situations that they're in, Virginia Tech should have lost to North Carolina. That was a big-time misleading box score last week. They bounced back from the Old Dominion game to beat Duke, which kind of, to be totally honest with you, feels like an outlier for this Virginia Tech team here this season. Bud Foster knows the option, faced it every year, been a longtime DC here, but also Virginia Tech's losses in the secondary and in the second level with the linebackers. So, you know, they're kind of running a little bit thin on that side. From a Georgia Tech standpoint, at VaTech, at North Carolina, Miami at home, Virginia at home. Virginia is much better than any of us thought. At Georgia, you're Georgia Tech. You're sitting there at 3-4. You're running out of winnable games to get yourself to a bowl. That's got to be a consideration from a handicapping standpoint now at this time of the year. You definitely want to be looking to see what's on the horizon for these teams because they may give you more of an effort if that's a game they need to win for bowl eligibility. Similarly, if a team gets to a point where they can't win 6 games, you want to keep that in mind as well. So the only thing I would say about this game is it's Thursday night. People are going to want to have action. The only thing that stands out to me is that move down from 4.5 to 3.5 with VaTech having extra prep time, reverse line move. If you have to have action on this one, that leads me to believe that Georgia Tech is the right side. But, you know, again, I mean, don't force yourself into action on a game where you don't feel strongly.
Yeah, I agree. I think that this would be, you know, for me, it would have to be a force, and I'm not going to do that. I don't even know what to do with the total in this game because you know what Georgia Tech's going to do. They're going to take their time. They're going to eat up a bunch of clock as they go down the field. Virginia Tech not really playing terribly fast either. Virginia Tech's defense isn't as good as it's been in the past. Georgia Tech's defense isn't very good, so I can't trust too low of a number to take the under, but I don't like taking overs with Georgia Tech at all, so I'll stay away from this one.
All right, we'll do the pick 6 segment here. I know that you're going to be flying more blind than usual with this because, you know, you were out of town for the weekend, didn't have a whole lot of time to update your stuff. I usually surprise you with the games anyway, so you're kind of going off the cuff. But like I said, I know that preparation not as easy to do here for this one. So I'm sure none of these will be all that strong of opinions, but I just want to keep with tradition here and do the pick 6 anyway. So start with game 105-106 Thursday night. Toledo, Western Michigan. Western Michigan up from a 4-point favorite to a 6-point favorite.
Okay, so one of the craziest things that I saw about the numbers as I was looking at them late last night, you know, I get back late last night. I'm looking kind of in the middle of the night at what happened during the day on Sunday. I think BetOnline opened this game at as with Toledo as a favorite. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think it was Toledo was the favorite. Just a terrible line there, but I would still take Western Michigan here. I totally agree with this line move. I think Toledo is kind of proving at this point that they are not the team that they've been in the past. Western Michigan, to me, a team that can run the ball well. Toledo, I don't even think their offense is really that good. If you look at their offensive numbers, they've been skewed based on, you know, getting short fields, getting a lot of really good special teams plays. They scored, 63 points or whatever it was against Nevada in a game where they didn't really even have that many yards. So, to me, I think Toledo is probably still a little overvalued. You know, obviously, the line has moved pretty significantly here.
I'm looking at my odds screen. You're absolutely right. This line opened Toledo -1.5 at BetOnline. And BetOnline's been really good with these numbers for the most part this year. That was a big miss, and I wish I had been around to pick that one off. By the way, for those that talk about getting the best of the number, that's why I tell you to try and get the best number that you can, because the best of the number technically is 1.5 here, and one person got that, and then one other person got -1. Then it flipped all the way to Western Michigan -2. So get the best number that you can, and anybody that tells you they got the best number, I mean, if they got, you know, Western Michigan +1.5, good for them. Game 107-108, Ball State and Ohio. Ohio up to a 10-point, or not up to, they are a 10-point favorite here in this one.
This one would be a total pass. I don't even really know what to do with this game. I think Ohio's been a big disappointment this year. Ball State's not a team that I trust either. You know, this is one where, like you said, I'm going a little bit more by gut feel than even normal here. But, you know, Ohio, I guess, is my slight lean based on the fact that I trust their coaching staff more, and I still think they're better than what they've played. So I'll say Ohio -10, but please don't weight this one very heavily if you're listening from home.
Well, that's the reason I wanted to talk about it. Like you said, Ohio's been a disappointment. And you sort of wonder as you get later into the season, these teams that have been disappointing, do they have it in them to kind of flip the switch? Because as bad as, you know, as much of a disappointment as Ohio has been this year, I mean, they're still right there in the MAC East. They still have the chance to get themselves to the conference championship game because they still play Miami of Ohio and they still play Buffalo. So you kind of look at it and you say, you know, does this team show what it's supposed to be here at some point? And I think there's a little bit of that in the line where the fact that they are a double-digit favorite, despite being a disappointment, you know, again, kind of reading the context clues in the market. And if you are somebody that missed the weekend or is trying to catch up, those context clues in the market can be very, very important for you. Like, I think there's one a little bit here too. Game 113-114, Baylor makes the long trip out to Morgantown. West Virginia is a 14-point favorite.
I'm leaning toward Baylor plus points here. I think Matt Rhule is a good underdog coach. West Virginia, to me, is still a team that I don't trust that much. I think their defensive numbers are better than what they should be because they haven't played very many good offenses. I know Will Grier is going to put up some big numbers against Baylor. I think Baylor will score a little bit more than most people would think as well. So I think my leans in this game would be Baylor and the over.
Well, and again, the context clue that I'm looking at here, West Virginia has been, I think, over-respected in the marketplace. I think that, you know, the steam that they've gotten week after week, while they have covered some numbers here at various points throughout the season, it felt to me like they were overvalued. Now you've got Baylor, you know, with some extra prep time, but they're taking that long trip out to Morgantown, which is never easy. West Virginia has been a big favorite game in and game out for the most part. And then this number is only 14. Now, my number is 15, so it's right there in line with mine. But again, that's kind of what I'm talking about is you feel like West Virginia should be a bigger favorite in this role than they actually are. Thursday night in Morgantown, couches on fire, everything like that, and the number's only 14. So, again, context clues can be very, very important for you out there. How about this one? Game 115-116, Miami, Florida, up from 1.5 to 3.5 market-wide on the road at Boston College.
Another game that I don't have a strong lean on at all. This is a spot where, you know, Miami's defense is clearly the best unit on the field here. So in theory, I would want to take Miami, but this line has moved up, I believe. It looks like it was 1.5 or 2. Now it's 3.5. So to me, the line value is gone on Miami. I would pass on this game. You know, for the purposes of this segment, I'll say my slight lean is Miami, but I won't bet this game.
This is one to me. Again, you start talking about context clues that are out there. Miami's not a real popular team in the sharp community, you know, because they look really good against bad teams and look really bad against good teams. Boston College is somewhere in the middle, but to see this one cross through the key number of 3 early on in the week, see that power ratings value on Miami, again, kind of stands out to me, feels a little bit significant there. All right, one more game, and then we'll get into a game that you've got hopefully a stronger opinion on for your free pick. Game 167-168, the cocktail party in Jacksonville, Georgia, Florida, both off of buys. 7 reduced juice or even money. A 6.5 has repopped back there in the marketplace with Georgia favored at a neutral site.
Yeah, I pick Georgia in this game. I like this one better than some of the others we've been talking about. You know, I trust Georgia more. This is a Florida team that I know they've looked good at times this year. I think they still have to prove it against a really good team on a consistent basis. I know they beat LSU. That was a home game. This is not a home game. Georgia, a team that, you know, had a disappointment recently. I think they're a well-coached team. Not saying that I think Florida is a poorly coached team necessarily, but I think that Georgia is a very well-coached team. I think they also have the more talented team. I think this sets up as a better spot for Georgia here.
Interesting game, and quite frankly, I think this is the most important game in college football this weekend because of the implications for the SEC East, whoever's going to lose to Alabama there in Atlanta. But, you know, this is probably the biggest game of the weekend, I would say. So with that, we'll kick the extra point on the pick 6 here. Well, I guess we won't because that's only 6. Whatever. In any event, what's the free pick you've got for our listeners today?
I will say, to be fair here, that I don't feel as strongly about anything here as I normally would. I think I've won the last 3 free picks here, so hopefully you've been able to take advantage of those. I would say bet this one a little bit smaller because I did have a smaller amount of time to get ready for this one. But I'm going to take Florida International minus the points against Western Kentucky. It was about 3:30 in the morning when I was watching the replay of how this game ended. Reading some statuses and seeing how this game ended, the Western Kentucky game from last weekend, sorry. Western Kentucky, the way they lost their game on Saturday, it's kind of mind-blowing. You can watch that 3 or 4 times and just sit there and say, what the hell just happened? I mean, it was amazing. If you haven't seen that yet, go back and watch the end of the Old Dominion and Western Kentucky game. But I think that Western Kentucky is a poorly coached team. I think that FIU deserves credit for being a well-coached team. They've surprised me to the upside consistently both last year and this year. So based on a really disappointing finish and based on a coaching advantage, I'm going to take FIU in this one.
I like that one. And also for Western Kentucky here, 1-6 on the season. They've got 5 games left. You know what that means. FIU at Middle Tennessee, at Florida Atlantic, UTEP at Louisiana Tech. So they still have to play 3 of the better teams here in Conference USA. They are not going to a bowl game. They probably weren't anyway, but with that loss last week, definitely tough for them to come back. Kyle Hunter at Kyle Hunter Picks on Twitter, huntersportspicks.com is the website. What's going on over there right now?
Well, if you haven't already, sign up for that free pick newsletter. Another free pick winner this past weekend had Utah as the free play on Saturday. Didn't send one out since I was gone over the weekend for the NFL, but that's 7 straight free pick winners. 75-39 run. So I know a lot of people have been taking advantage of that. And if you haven't already signed up for that, you can do so at huntersportspicks.com for free.
Again, like I said, at Kyle Hunter Picks on Twitter. Kyle Hunter, busy afternoon in front of you, man. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll talk to you again next week.
All right. Thanks, man.
Good stuff there with professional handicapper Kyle Hunter of huntersportspicks.com. Coming up on our Tuesday edition of Bang the Book Radio, we'll have Brian Blessing from Sportsbook Radio and Vegas Hockey Hotline joining us. We'll chat NFL, NHL, and who knows, whatever else with him, maybe a little bit of golf as well. And then in the second half of that show, Rolf Michaels from wagertalk.com. We'll chat with him about putting together college basketball power ratings, then also college football and the NFL. Wednesday, Brian Leonard, Wes Reynolds. Thursday, Brad Powers and Tony George. Friday Super Contest segment, Brent from DSI Sportsbook. That'll do it for me. Thank you so much for listening, everybody, and I will talk to you again tomorrow.